I'm really excited to be giving this chairing because as one of the leading organizers and you know of helping the student walkout at Seattle Central Community College, which kicked off. It's really great to be here with my fellow comrades and here at this meeting to see all these people to talk about what's going on around the country, this wave of counter recruitment. So I won't spend too much time because I think we really got to get to this get talking here. But I'd like to introduce our speakers today. We have Elizabeth, who helped organize the protest which resulted in the cancellation of CIA recruiters at NYU. She's currently involved in counter-recruiting work at LaGuardia Community College and helping organize a counter-recruiting contingent for September 24th protest. We have Katrina, who's a former member of the CAN Campus Anti-War Network Steering Committee and is currently involved in the College Not Combat campaign. Haras is an anti-war pro-Palestine activist involved in the City College counter-recruitment protest, which led to the attempted expulsion of three students and one staff member. These charges were later dropped after overwhelming support. Now I'd like to plug some books here real quick. Haras has contributed to The Struggle for Palestine, and it's a great read. You should pick it up at Haymarket. And our not-so-recent ISR anymore, last issue, has an article on the battle over military recruiters. And so definitely take a look at that. We got a nice picture of Katrina right here in it, too. So maybe she'll autograph it for you afterwards. But without any further ado, Elizabeth, go ahead.
The U.S. military is facing a crisis of manpower in the midst of an occupation meant to be the demonstration case for U.S. power after the Cold War. The military has been unable to meet its recruiting goals, according to Major General Michael Rochelle, the U.S. Army's recruiting commander. Today's conditions represent the most challenging conditions we have seen in recruiting in my 33 years in this uniform. At the same time that recruitment has fallen sharply, a new movement has sprung up on college campuses and high schools and in communities of students and parents who are tired of being targeted for military service and are determined to get recruiters out of their schools and their neighborhoods. And this new movement has been a beacon for people disgusted by what the U.S. is doing in Iraq and is providing a new model for how the anti-war movement can reemerge as a force to end the war. And in this speech, I want to give the context that movement is developing in. Of course, that context begins with the occupation of Iraq. The U.S. wants to control Iraq's oil to ensure a strategic advantage over its economic rivals like China. It wants to privatize the country and pave the way for U.S. companies to control the economy. It wants to establish permanent military bases in the oil-rich Middle East. And maybe most of all, it wants to send a message to the entire world that what the world's only superpower does is says goes. And if you get in the way of the U.S., you can expect the full force of history's most powerful military to come raining down on your country, as has happened in Iraq. And given that these are the goals of the occupation, it is perhaps not surprising that the occupation has produced resistance from Iraqis who actually don't think that their oil should be controlled by Halliburton or their cities destroyed by U.S. bombs and chemical weapons. And this resistance has turned what U.S. politicians evidently expected to be a cakewalk into more of a quagmire, to the extent that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld made headlines a week ago by stating that the insurgency could go on for any number of years. Insurgencies tend to go on 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 years. An unusually honest admission, right, from one of the most dishonest men on the planet, but evidently designed to prepare Americans for the fact that this is an occupation that they expect to continue for years and years. And that's produced a fundamental problem for the U.S. government that expected this to be their demonstration case. They must crush the resistance, but who exactly... Who is going to do that? Because when Bush and Congress say they want to go to Iraq, they don't actually mean that they personally want to go to Iraq. They actually have something different in mind. And so the task of crushing the resistance, it will have to be done by someone else. And the greatest hope of the U.S. was that by this point, the Iraqis would be doing it themselves. That's what the strategy of Iraqification is, to get one segment of Iraqis, namely the police and the military, to kill another segment of Iraqis, namely the resistance, all for the benefit of the Americans. That's the idea, but unfortunately for U.S. imperialism, Iraqification is failing, partly because large swaths of the Iraqi security forces actually have a lot more sympathy for the resistance than they do for the occupation. And that is the context for the absolute panic to sign people up for the military, because the way that the ruling class always fights its wars is to get somebody else to do it for them. Iraqis won't do it, and so the task falls to the U.S. working class. And this is a dynamic, by the way, that did not begin with this war, but has in fact been true of every war. As the American socialist Eugene Debs wrote during World War I, the master class has always declared the wars, the subject class has always fought the battles. The master class has had all to gain and nothing to lose, while the subject class has had nothing to gain and all to lose, especially their lives. But the only way the ruling class can get people to sign up for this is either to lie to them or to take advantage of how few opportunities our society really provides to people. In effect, our society is taking a group of people and who are being systematically denied every opportunity, told that they will never be able to afford college, they will only be able to get the most demeaning, low-paid work, and they will never earn much respect. But there is a way out. They can join the military, and that's the essence of the recruiting pitch. But in truth, most of the benefits that they promise are lies. Although college money is the number one reason people sign up for military service, only 15% of soldiers wind up with any sort of college degree. And in fact, the college benefits program is the only division of the military to actually turn a profit to the tune of $72 million a year, because so many more soldiers pay money into the program than ever see anything out of it. Veterans actually earn less on average than non-veterans of comparable backgrounds do, and veterans of the Iraq War have already begun turning up in homeless shelters. But in addition to the benefits of military service, recruiters also lie about the risks. For example, a lot of recruits are being promised that they have an opt-out of war clause in their contract. And then when they are being shipped off to Iraq, they discover that no such clause ever actually exists. But unfortunately, while the promised benefits of military service are mostly lies, the lack of other opportunities is not a lie. I was in a meeting recently where an older man asked a bunch of high school students, what can people like me do to inform your generation about the alternatives to military service? And one of the students, she said, well, that's kind of the problem. For people from our school, there are not a lot of alternatives. But even despite that pressure on people, the military does not actually rely on students to decide for themselves whether they would like to sign up for the military. The annual recruiting budget is now $4 billion, of which $300 million is reserved for advertising, and recruiters set up at shopping malls, rock concerts, NASCAR races, beaches. They give out special video games. One of the more offensive forms of recruitment is probably the Ay Carumba tour, aimed specifically at Latinos. But the main way that recruiters have of reaching young people, especially high school students, is through their schools. And to quote the U.S. Army School Recruiting Program Handbook, which, that's it. This is the official handbook for Army recruiters working in schools, and it says, the objective for military recruiters is to own the school. And the handbook offers practical advice on just how to do that, handily arranged into month-by-month guidelines. So, in August, you should contact the football coach and volunteer to assist with practice. In September, arrange to eat lunch in the school cafeteria. January is Martin Luther King's birthday, so be sure to wear your dress blues. Also, this is a quote. Contact your first-year college students to see if they return to school. How is their second semester financial situation? Yeah. So, Recruiting individual students, meanwhile, is accomplished mostly through harassment, but aided by some convenient laws. In high schools, this takes the form of the No Child Left Behind Act, which requires schools to give student contact information to the military unless their parents specifically opt out. But that act is actually just the beginning. To aid recruitment, the Pentagon is now collecting information on all high school students age 16 and up and all college students. Their database includes phone numbers, social security numbers, grades, courses taken, and ethnicity, very important for deciding whether they would like to target you. Reportedly, they have information on 12 million young people so far in this database. And it's pretty, I think, mind-boggling to think about the level of resources that go into this level of recruitment at schools that are themselves underfunded. A woman I work with in the Campus Anti-War Network, she attended a recruiting event that was also a field trip for a local high school. And at this event, the kids were playing football with professional players. They all were given personalized dog tags to take home. And they got to play on a monster truck, but apparently that was no big deal because the year before had an Apache helicopter. She also, one of the recruiters she met at this event, teaches a class in that high school called How to Get a Job in the Real World. And I will let you guess what he recommends. I think what all of this makes clear is that for working class students, and in particular for students of color, schools are not so much meant to teach kids how to think creatively or to prepare them to live a better life, but they are meant to prepare young people for their future roles. And for many young people, I think the message being sent is very clear. Your future is the military. And it's actually a message being sent at an earlier and earlier age, as even elementary schools now get tanks for little kids to come and play on. But despite all of this pressure on students to sign up, recruitment is way down. And this is causing some degree of panic among the military brass and the politicians. The Army in particular is so far behind on its annual recruitment goal, they must exert what military officials call a monumental effort to avoid missing their goal for the first time since 1999. But it's not just the Army, it's the other branches, the National Guard, the Reserves. They're all facing shortfalls. And there are a number of reasons for plummeting recruitment, the most obvious being that over 1,700 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq and over 6,500 wounded. But I think the backdrop to the unwillingness to sign up is actually opposition to the war itself. And that has a tremendous impact on whether people consider the risk of dying or of having to kill another person to be worth it. And that's why recruitment is down among Black Americans most of all. The percentage of new recruits who are Black has dropped 40% since the year 2000, which is just tremendous. And clearly, in a country as racist as ours, that's not because Black Americans are the ones who have the best access to alternative job opportunities, but it is because Blacks disproportionately oppose the war. A report prepared for the military concluded, more African Americans identify having to fight for a cause they don't support as a barrier to military service. In the face of this falling recruitment, the military has become truly desperate. Recently, the Army ended its policy of automatically excluding recruits who lie about their qualifications in favor of considering their total value to the military. Recruiters are also being put under enormous pressure to meet their quotas at all costs, which has resulted in a spate of recruiter abuses. And it's not that there weren't abuses before. I met a woman a week ago doing counter-recruitment at a community college who almost joined the military after recruiters convinced her not to tell her mother about it and to lie about the fact that she has asthma. So recruiters have always lied, but the crisis in recruitment, I think, is both making it more common and also is opening up the space for those abuses to get national attention. And that's why on May 20th, after a Houston recruiter was recorded on tape telling a young man he would be arrested if he didn't show up at his recruiting station that day, the Army took the unprecedented step of holding a national values stand down. They halted all recruitment across the U.S. for the day to supposedly retrain recruiters in ethics and the law. And obviously, this is a PR move on the Army's part, but for us, it was an opportunity. So the Campus Anti-War Network and other groups called it as a National Day of Action and protested recruiting stations across the country. And that, I think, that's what has to be our model, to take their weakness and turn it into our strength, because we want recruitment to fail. The abuses and the lies and the poverty draft and also the treatment of soldiers in Iraq and when they come home reveal that what they are to the military is cannon fodder. Recruiters are taking advantage of the extreme economic and racial inequalities in our society to pull people into an institution where they face daily racism, sexism. A third of women in the military are sexually assaulted. Homophobia in the form of the bigoted No Child Left Behind Act. And, I mean, these are all... Oh, I'm sorry.
It's all bad,
but it is the bigoted "don't ask, don't tell." But you know, these are all reasons to oppose recruitment. I mean, it's disgusting. But most fundamentally, I think we have to oppose recruitment because the U.S. military is an institution dedicated to carrying out imperialism the whole world over. Its job is to get poor people from this country to kill poor people in other countries, all for the benefit of wealthy Americans who get richer and richer off of other people's oil. And the fact that they're having trouble recruiting people for that project is a victory for the entire world.
As Elizabeth has pointed out, the brutality of the occupation and its cost here at home is fueling a resistance both here and in Iraq. As the military becomes increasingly desperate for new recruits, students, parents, community activists have turned to their attention to opposing the presence of military recruiters on campuses across the country. Although challenges to military recruitment have been going on for decades, there's been an upsurge in the number of protests and actions over the last several months that is developing into a new national movement. A major boost came for the counter-recruitment movement in November 2004 when a federal appeals court overturned the Solomon Amendment, a federal law that ties federal funding for schools to the presence of military recruiters on campuses. The court ruled that schools have a right to exclude recruiters if they have anti-discrimination policies, which luckily most do, under the auspices that they have a First Amendment right to ban recruiters because of their bigoted "don't ask, don't tell" policy. This opened the door for activists to demand that recruiters be barred from campuses around the country. The counter-recruitment movement gained national headlines when on January 20th, 2005, the day of Bush's second inauguration, students at Seattle Central Community College confronted military recruiters on their campus. A group of 50 swelled to over 300 as activists held a rally and an occupation of the recruiters' own table in order to prevent them from handing out literature. Recruiters had to be escorted off campus among chants of "don't come back" as students pelted them and rained down their own literature over their heads. The victory at SCCC gave confidence to students around the country to confront military recruiters in similar protests around the country. And the next several months, a wave of similar actions happened on dozens of campuses across the country. In some cases, they represented the activism of a small group of dedicated students who were able to galvanize other students' anger behind them and help push people to confront military recruiters. In other cases, there were more spontaneous outbursts of anger against budget cuts and the war in general. I myself was involved with a similar demonstration on March 9th, 2005, in which activists... of members of Students Against War at San Francisco State University, a member of the Campus Anti-War Network chapter, organized a demonstration against counter-recruiters. We rallied in the main plaza with about 200 students, marched up into our student center, and rallied in front of the recruiters' table, chanting them down for over 2 hours, and then held a peaceful sit-in where students talked about the war and "don't ask, don't tell" and everything they opposed about military recruiters. And in the end, the recruiters were forced to leave over an hour early without a single recruit. High school students have also been a major driving force behind the counter-recruitment movement. They won major victories this semester for their rights to protest anti-recruitment views at high schools like Minneapolis's Kennedy High School and Tacoma's Foss High School. Students at a high school in Montclair, New Jersey, organized an opt-out campaign, resulting in 80% of high school students signing the opt-out form to combat the horrible No Child Left Behind Act. Students at a New York City public school in the Bronx spontaneously kicked off military recruiters, and in their words, just got a bunch of their friends together, swamped the recruiters' tables, and yelled, "We don't want you here," until we left. Parents have joined the choir voices demanding that military recruiters not have unlimited access to their children. A Department of Defense survey from last November, the latest that's been done, shows that only 25% of parents would recommend military service to their children. That's down from 42% in August 2003. A recruiter told the New York Times, "I had one father say, if he saw me on his doorstep, I better bring some protection with me." At Seattle Garfield High School, dozens packed a meeting of the Parent Students Association in May that voted against allowing military recruiters on campuses. Community activists have also been a major part of the counter-recruitment movement, helping to aid students who confront military recruiters. In San Francisco, I've been a part of the Calls on Combat campaign, a ballot initiative that states that the city opposes military recruiters being able to use public school facilities for recruitment, and that the city should also find ways to alleviate the economic draft by funding scholarships and job training for low-income students. Okay, these are some of the more exciting developments in the counter-recruitment movement, but there are many more that I just frankly don't have time to talk about. They're from people, you know, parents tabling next to recruiters, people leafling out of recruiting stations, and just the acts of 17-year-olds who under intense pressure are starting to stand up to recruiters and be like, "Hell no, we're not going to your war." These are exciting examples, but unfortunately, most of these people actually don't even know about each other right now. But we are beginning to see the beginning of a coalescing of a national movement. As the movement has gained momentum, it has drawn attention from those wishing to crush student activism and opposition against the war. Hostile administrations have clamped down on the rights of students to free speech. Hadass and I have both personally faced the wrath of an unsympathetic administration as a result of counter-recruitment protests taking place at the City College of New York and San Francisco State University, respectively. At SFSU, the administration singled out three individuals as well as two student organizations for disciplinary actions and sanctions resulting in the March 9th peaceful protests on campus. The majority of those active in the counter-recruitment movement fully support traditional counter-recruitment methods, which usually include efforts to cut through the misinformation around recruitment by providing material to potential recruits. However, there has been much debate about engaging in more militant or confrontational counter-recruitment actions that attempt to disrupt recruitment efforts and remove recruiters altogether from campuses. As a relatively new movement, activists are faced with many questions about the way to most effectively challenge recruiters on their campuses. Many feel that we have a right to both oppose the policies of the military and the war in Iraq, but question whether recruiters have just as much right to be there as us. In order to build an effective counter-recruitment movement, we must not only oppose the most egregious abuses of military recruiters, but their right to set foot on high school and university campuses. We cannot limit ourselves to just talking to students about better options because, as Elizabeth has pointed out, for working class and student of youth, there really aren't that many better options for them. And being hired to kill poor people of color in Iraq or Afghanistan, I would say hardly counts as a career option. As already noted, the military's bigoted don't ask, don't tell policy gives students a legal right to insist that military recruiters not be allowed on campus. Therefore, when administrations refuse to uphold their own anti-discrimination policy, it falls on students to be the ones to do so. However, some activists still question whether the removal of recruiters is an infringing on recruiters' rights to free speech. This is not a new question for the counter-recruitment movement or for activists. Michael Letwin, who was a counter-recruitment activist at UMass Boston in the 1980s, took up this question when confronting then-hostile Chancellor Robert Corgan. People should know that Robert Corgan is also the current president of San Francisco State University and is behind the drive to punish me and several other students. Michael Letwin said, if organized crime set up a table to recruit assassins, would we defend the right to free speech? If heroin pushers recruited junkies, would crowds of angry students gather in their defense? Hardly. That type of speech is directly related to activity so obviously dangerous and wrong that no one defends them. Why then is military recruitment different? The military serves as the armed wing of big business and is actively encouraging racism and sexism. Its purpose is to suppress by murder popular movements, whether in Iraq or Vietnam, the non-white communities in the U.S., the unions, or the universities. As such, it is the most deadly and large-scale form of organized crime in the world today. It is legal, as was slavery over 100 years ago, only because those who make the laws, the corporations and their representatives, needed to survive. But like organized crime, heroin pushers, and slave traders, it has no right to organize anyone in its criminal activities. Legal or not, it must be stopped. It should also be pointed out that it is impossible at this point for the counter-recruitment movement to infringe on the free speech of the military. As Elizabeth has pointed out, the military has a budget of over $4 billion for counter-recruitment alone. Anyone who's turned on a TV, picked up a newspaper or magazine, ventured outside their home, I bet has seen an ad for some branch of the U.S. military. Not to mention the thousands of recruiters they send out to prowl malls, rock concerts, and low-income communities every day. There are also those who question whether confronting recruiters whether confrontational counter-recruitment protests are anti-recruiter or shooting the messenger. Military Family Speaks Out did not organizationally endorse the call on January 20th for protests around the value stand down, saying their emphasis on unscrupulous recruiters rather than a system of pressure for recruitment is very problematic. They claim that the demand stand up against predatory recruiters focused on recruiters themselves rather than the system of recruitment that recruitment fostered by today's military. As socialists, we of course agree that lies recruiters tell are ultimately rooted in a system that requires working class people and people of color to die and kill for empire. And exposing this should be a major focus of the counter-recruitment movement. However, just as we oppose the war crimes of U.S. troops in Iraq, we must oppose the lies of military recruiters at home. Both are acting at the behest of the Pentagon, and both are cannon fodder. But that doesn't mean that we should not oppose their actions at the behest of the Pentagon. In fact, protest is the only way to win them to our side, and that's evident from the Vietnam War movement. The question of whether activists confront recruiters is related to the question of what demands should be put forward by the counter-recruitment movement. There have been questions about whether we should delimit our slogans to denouncing the don't ask, don't tell policy or the lies recruiters tell and not muddy the message by talking about the war. This leads activists down the slippery slope of letting others limit the terms of debate for the counter-recruitment movement. Our goal is not just to oppose the worst abuses of military recruitment or try to make a more effective army, but to combat the whole framework that is used to justify U.S. imperialism. The growing anger against the occupation is the driving force behind the crisis in the military as well as the counter-recruitment movement. Taking on the issue of the war helps give people the confidence to continue to resist. The counter-recruitment movement is in its infancy, and I'm confident because of its ability to both tap into hatred of the war and produce tangible results, it will continue to both grow and bring in a whole new layer of activists.
Okay, hello. People see me over this podium. So as Elizabeth and Katrina have gone through, the U.S. Armed Forces is facing a crisis in manpower, which is tied to a growing unwillingness among those that are being asked to carry out this war to actually do so. And I think, incidentally, that's the reason why Bush had to end his speech the other night with a pitch to join the military. I think the truth is that the counter-recruitment movement is working. It's tapping into and helping to articulate and further grow a widespread sentiment among against being used as cannon fodder in an occupation that seems to have no end in sight, and in which it is young working-class kids that are being asked to sacrifice our lives for a war which only benefits the Halliburtons, the oil companies, and American empire building. And I think it's working for the very same reasons that resistance is swelling inside the ranks of the military, whether that's the reserve unit in January that defied orders to go on an unsafe mission to soldiers in the National Guard that questioned Donald Rumsfeld on national television, on the lack of proper equipment, to the thousands that have gone AWOL, to individual soldiers like Pablo Paredes and Camilo Mejia, who have taken an extraordinary stand against fighting a war that they feel is unjust, to the point that, you know, one of the media's experts, you know, they bring out all these, like, military experts, this guy, retired Marine Lieutenant General Bernard Traynor, recently told Newsday that among the troops in Iraq, there's a sense of grim determination to get on with a job, but all that is very fragile. Unless there's some indication of improvement or relief from constant pressure brought about by the stretch of manpower, then you're planting the seeds of trouble, and when it starts to grow, it becomes like a wildfire. And I think that, you know, Bernard Traynor should know, since he commanded infantry units in Vietnam, where the seeds of trouble within the armed forces did indeed become a wildfire of opposition. And it, indeed, just as the Army Reserves chief reported earlier this year that the reserves is becoming a, quote, rapidly degenerating into a broken force, the armed forces in Vietnam did become just that, a broken force, so much so that the government, no matter how hell-bent they were on winning the war in Vietnam, were just unable to muster the actual force necessary to prosecute it. And I actually wanted to go and take a minute to talk about what did stop the war in Vietnam, because I think it's actually relevant to what's both possible and necessary to do right now in the way that counter-recruitment fits into that. And I think part of the answer to that question is that actually by 1970, the U.S. Army was no longer the most powerful army in the world. It had become actually pretty useless as a fighting force. The Vietnamese people had for decades waged a heroic fight against French colonialism, against the Japanese invasion in World War II, and then against a U.S. occupation. And it was a popular struggle supported by the vast majority of Vietnamese. And the harder American forces moved to crush it, the more it actually galvanized support. And in this way, U.S. forces needed more and more and more troops to beat off what seemed like an endless supply of Vietnamese resistance fighters. By 1968, when the National Liberation Front waged a Tet Offensive, the American population, as well as soldiers themselves, became convinced without a doubt that they were fighting on the wrong side of an unwinnable war. And the parallels today are, of course, striking, because as the resistance in Iraq grows to the point where, like Elizabeth mentioned, Rumsfeld announcing it may take another 12 years to beat it. But it wasn't only the quagmire that Vietnam became that led to a degeneration within the armed forces. It was also the class contradictions within the armed force itself that made up of mostly high school educated young kids who were led into combat by middle-class, mostly white officers who were just looking to advance their military careers, but by and large, you know, weren't facing combat themselves. And one of the most common strategies in Vietnam, actually, were the search and destroy missions, where basically GIs were used as bait, you know, to draw out NLF fire, and then the helicopters that were flown by officers would come in and shoot down, you know, and then, to kill the Vietnamese fighters, but incidentally, a quarter of American deaths actually came from friendly fire from those helicopters. And then when the battle was over, the officers would fly off in their helicopters to the safety of the base, while GIs were left to fight it out on the ground. And so by 1968, troops increasingly looked to avoid combat. Cases of mutiny skyrocketed. Within 3 years of Tet, a full quarter of the armed forces had gone AWOL, and there were at least 800 to 1,000, if not more, of what the army came to call fragging, which was basically, you know, when the troops either injured or killed their own officers rather than go out and be killed or kill. Cases of insubordination were so great that it became impossible to punish soldiers for rebelling. And I think this is exactly the wildfire that Bernard Traynor is so afraid of today in Iraq. And in the case of Vietnam, these troops gained the confidence to resist because of a growing mass anti-war movement at home. Campuses in particular were on fire, some of them quite literally. In 1970, in response to Nixon's invasion of Cambodia, students at 60 universities went out on strike. And then when the National Guard killed four students, student protesters at Kent State, 536 schools were shut down, and campus demonstrations took place at a rate of over 100 a day. And at that time, a Gallup poll showed that campus unrest was the number one concern of the American public. And not only did activism at home help to fuel resistance within the armed forces, but conversely, you know, the other way around, troops returning from Vietnam helped to fuel and to lead the anti-war movement at home. And so I think today, as counter-recruitment activists, we find ourselves in a context that's just as ripe with contradictions as Vietnam-era activists found themselves in the 1960s, a war which is similarly being waged against the rights of a people to determine their own future, a war which is being fought on the basis of lies against an abstract enemy in Vietnam, communism, today terrorism, and a war which, despite all the administration's rosy, you know, predictions, is more and more obviously an unwinnable quagmire by the day. But I think we also find ourselves, as the new generation of activists did in the 1960s, up against some serious political challenges as well. First and foremost is the brutal determination, I think, of those that are prosecuting this war to continue to do so at any cost. And, you know, I think that's where the repression against activists at SFSU, Santa Cruz, at City College, as well as the attack on left-wing anti-war professors, and, of course, the massive campaign of fear and intimidation against Arabs and Muslims since 9/11. And I think the message they're sending reads loud and clear, which is shut up or we'll shut you up. But I think that it's not inevitable that they could actually get away with it. I think what our experience at City College, at CCNY, actually showed was that it is possible, by going on the offensive and not silencing ourselves, we were able to galvanize some serious support, especially on a campus like City College, which is a working-class campus made up of mostly students who are people of color. You know, people at City College aren't unfamiliar with the idea of cops, or in the case of City College, security that's trained by cops, you know, who will beat you, arrest you, and then claim that you assaulted them. So as a result, you know, we got over 1,000 different letters of support, signatures poured in from around the country, people sending in money from all over the country. The people that run the campus TV station at City College actually took our press conference and, like, played it every day, much to my embarrassment, every day, over and over again. Which, despite my embarrassment, was good, you know, for the all the students and professors, you know, not to mention administrators and security. Got to see that every day. You know, me and a couple of my fellow arrestees were at an ATM on 125th Street in Harlem, and, like, some, you know, random guy turned to me and was like, "Miss, are they going to let you back in school?" When I told him I thought that they would, he said, "Oh, that's good. I just want you to know the whole city supports you." So, you know, I think all that to say that, you know, when we go on the offensive as opposed to being put on the defensive, we can galvanize a tremendous amount of support. I think that the second challenge that we face is a political one within the movement itself. You know, just as the new left of the 1960s had to contend with the damage that was inflicted, you know, by 1950s-style McCarthyism, I think today we have to contend with in some ways, a similarly great challenge, which is that a political link has been severed between the radicalism of the 1960s and today. The generation of activists in the 60s who came out to oppose the war drew lessons from that struggle that turned hundreds of thousands of people into what, you know, called knee-jerk anti-imperialists. And they learned that U.S. intervention abroad always led to misery and was always wielded in the interest of American economic and strategic aims, no matter what the lofty rhetoric our rulers used. Today, the left has unfortunately lost most of its knee-jerk anti-imperialism, which I think has led to a significant amount of political disarray and confusion. The break between 60s radical movements and today's was carried out through a conscious political and economic attack, which is, you know, I think what Reaganism was all about. It was also a result of Clintonism, which convinced many previous anti-imperialists to back military missions and back really the rehabilitation of military interventions abroad under the guise of what were now called humanitarian missions. And I think this past year, John Kerry's election campaign against Bush continued that process. Much of the leadership of the anti-war movement dissolved itself into support for a candidate who promised us he would hunt down and kill the terrorists. And many leading organizations consciously toned down their demands in order to not embarrass their pro-war candidate and actually ended up demobilizing the movement. And I think this left millions of people who were against the war with little alternative to look to, either in the ballot box or on the streets. And when Bush won the elections, many of the leading anti-war organizations concluded that we actually have to further tone down our message in order to appeal to a more conservative America. But I think, you know, the assumption that Americans are too right-wing to be mobilized against the war is simply not true. You know, there's obviously anecdotal evidence, like the support that we got at City College, you know, also all the polls, you know, that today 6 in 10 Americans believe that we should either partially or fully withdraw from Iraq. Bush's approval rating has actually sunk to an all-time low of 42%. And I think as it's become increasingly clear that Bush's popularity is plummeting, there are some forces in the anti-war movement that have gotten excited about the possibility of a turnaround in the movement. But I think that all too often still focusing on backing kind of very vague legislation in Congress for an eventual timetable for withdrawal is the key next step. But what I would argue is that the anti-war movement needs to orient on activism and not on politicians, and this needs to be built up from the grassroots level, which is exactly why I think the growth of the counter-recruitment movement this past year is not only an exciting but actually a very important development. You know, in the 1960s, while different, more established organizations vied for the leadership of the anti-war movement, it was actually students who developed new formations and organized locally that were able to transform the anti-war movement into a mass movement that really shook U.S. society to its core. Or another example of the civil rights movement where local activists, you know, sat in to challenge Jim Crow segregation, and this really happened from the bottom up, you know, people learning from each other's struggles and it spreading in that way. And I think today the counter-recruitment movement is similarly spreading from campus to campus like that, drawing lessons and examples from every success and every challenge. And that's why I think the counter-recruitment movement has the potential to really act as a front edge or at least a key edge of turning around the anti-war movement and rebuilding it on a stronger political basis. Its strength is tied to both the energy that, you know, we get off of campuses and the potential for student struggle, as well as the fact that it, along with the growing resistance in the military, puts the people that are most affected by the drive to war, that is working class people, at the very center of the movement to stop it. And in this way, I think we become not only a moral force, but can tap a real power to choke off the supply line to the military and make our contribution to creating an armed force which is as useless and as broken as it was in Vietnam.